Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Well, homelessness is on the rise in the U.S. We're going to talk about that first here on Radioactivity. And then later, we'll talk with one of the Democratic candidates for governor. There are three announced candidates running for the Democratic nomination for governor. We'll talk with one of them at the bottom of the hour. But first, the annual Still No Room at the Inn event is coming up this Friday, December 8th. Carolers will travel through downtown St. Petersburg to mark the problem of homelessness. And we're going to talk about that right now with three people who are involved in the event. John Stewart is here. He's been involved with Still No Room at the Inn for years and years. And John, welcome to WMNF. Great to see you.
Thank you.
And also here is, we've got two other guests with us right now. Josue Robles Caraballo, and Josue is on the phone with us. And Josue, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here. You're a professor of architecture, right?
Oh, yes. I've been with the program for around 5 years now, and it's great that he has given you the opportunity to work in, you know, projects such like this and help as we can.
Okay, and we're going to talk to you about what is being done about to try to build homes for the homeless. And also here is our next guest, and Sabina. Sabina, I don't have your last name in front of me, but Sabina, welcome to WMNF. You're with Celebrate Outreach, and Sabrina, your last name is?
Oh, hi, Rob. Yes, this is Sabina. My last name is Von Alok.
Okay, and thank you for coming on. John Stewart, let me start with you. Locally, how big is the homelessness problem?
Well, in St. Petersburg, we estimate there are 6,000 homeless in Pinellas County, and there are about 3,100 homeless kids in schools in Pinellas County, of all things. And
3,100 homeless kids in schools?
Yes, and may not be an absolutely accurate count because some of them don't know that they're homeless. They wouldn't classify themselves that way. What Celebrate Outreach is doing is it is approaching the problem of homelessness with direct service. We do two meals a week, and it's also looking at permanent housing solutions, and that's where the tiny homes for homeless vets comes in.
Okay, and Sabina, tell us more. You're with the group Celebrate Outreach. Tell us more about the dimensions of the problem of homelessness.
Oh, it's huge, and coincidentally, just yesterday on NPR, they did a piece reporting on a national count that occurs every year called A Point in Time, and in 2017, volunteers spread throughout the country and counted over 500,000 people spending the night on the streets or in shelters, and 40,000 of those were veterans. Now, in St. Petersburg, there are an estimated 329. And really, Rob, when you are doing these mail share programs, either Friday night or Saturday, and you come face-to-face with these homeless veterans, it is impossible to not feel compelled to mobilize and develop housing for our neighbors in need. So that is why we are pumped up about this tiny homes project.
And talk about meal share. What is meal share?
Meal share program is on Friday nights at the Unitarian Universalist Church of St. Petersburg. We have a picnic for people in need. No questions asked. We have volunteers who have been doing this steadily every Friday of the year. And we set up a buffet line, and we have between 80 and 100 guests. And then Saturday morning, a similar thing goes on at Trinity Lutheran in St. Petersburg, and they serve upward to 200 people. They have breakfast every Saturday.
And you see a lot of veterans. Tell us more about how it strikes you. I mean, what's your sense about why these veterans are homeless?
Every veteran has their own story. Every person who is homeless has their own story. They could be facing PTSD, mental illness. What I've heard is stories where they get a subsidy, a monthly subsidy. They go check out the housing where they're assigned to go, and it is unsafe. They are not willing to stay there. It is drug-ridden. And so choices like that along the way, they could be working They could have a car that doesn't work. Transportation is no longer available. So many are just on the brink. You know, there's just a many stories and varied.
The number of homeless veterans is seems to be chronic. I mean, that's something that we've covered here at WMNF for the last 30 or 35 years. Why do you think it remains so intractable?
Just for this, well, reasons I didn't mention, but, you know, are number one and two, I guess, you know, the lack of affordable housing. And, you know, in St. Petersburg, we're experiencing a wonderful time of prosperity, but it takes its toll on housing. So the inventory of affordable housing is steadily plummeting. That's a huge problem. Rent, same with rent. You know, the market rent is not affordable to so many people who either have zero or very small income.
Well, you mentioned that report yesterday on NPR. We reported it, too. One of the things in that report is that homelessness is on the rise. It hasn't risen since 2010, and now homelessness is back on the rise. John, what's your take on that?
I think what we see happening in St. Petersburg, which is there is less and less affordable housing. As Sabina said, there's this wonderful explosion of housing, but not very little of it is affordable. And the widening gap between the very rich and the rest of us continues to widen. And that is the big issue. The big issue is housing, which is why the Tiny Homes Program is so exciting.
All right, we're going to take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. On the first half of the show today, we're talking about homelessness, and we're talking about the Still No Room in the Inn event this Friday in St. Petersburg. Let's bring Josue Robles Carabalo back on. Josue, I think we've heard talk so far about these tiny homes. You're the person behind the Tiny Homes Project. What is it?
In essence, it seems like a very long time ago, but we started to question how would be the ideal home for someone that he has been or is experiencing homelessness. Because the one thing that we did identify is that that could potentially be any of us. And that kind of changed how we looked at the whole housing crisis, because it's not just a shelter that we need to design for or try to acquire, but more so a home that enables the residents and someone that has many challenges like PTSD, it might have anxiety, and also economics. The economics factor is a big challenge. How do you design a home that is affordable, that is easy to maintain, and ultimately empowers the resident? And it doesn't become something that it's a burden along the way, but it's something that it allows them to connect to the community and also to what they want to achieve personally. And I think that was really important to us, to not just give the residents or the future resident the opportunity, but also do it in a way that it contributes and benefits the community that they will be a part of now.
Have you built these homes? Do they exist?
No, these homes do not exist. But I think one of what we're striving is that, you know, with efforts such as Celebrate Outreach, is that public outreach becomes greater. And we start to talk about the necessity of starting to challenge how we deliver housing. And I think that's one of the greatest benefits or assets of this of Celebrate Outreach, is that it has incorporated students, that it also has allowed them, you know, students now are the future of future architects and future designers. And if we could also have them think about this socially charged project, it would definitely give us a better opportunity in the future to have them in charge or a charge.
Mm-hmm. Josue, you teach at USF and you teach architecture. What would a tiny home look like? What would it contain, and how would it compare? How big would it be?
You know, one of the things that we have to address is that everyone is enamored by what we see on TV and how cute these tiny homes look. But we start to think about not necessarily how it looks, but how would it work and how would it function? And what do you want to have a tiny home next to your house? Or do you, what would be what you need, but also what the community wants? And like going back to size and materials and the design, we start to think about something like natural light. You know, what does that do for someone that is experiencing anxiety? Or for most of us, we need it. We also started to look at historic, you know, precedents such as a porch. That became really important for most of the students and for us ultimately to identify that, you know, to use something that is kind of like overlooked, but it was very successful before. So why are we not incorporating that now in our design? And yeah, we believe that that's something that is a must. And yes, the tiny homes are not as tiny. They're more around the 500 square feet. But we believe that that's what needs, the size that it needs to be able to not only work on the long term, but also be able to socially engage with, one, the community, but also with peers and family members.
Have you identified a neighborhood or places here in the Bay Area where you think tiny homes would be appropriate?
We are started to looking. So we're looking this at a very comprehensive way. And what we also found is that if we could use lots that are substandard that you cannot use for a regular 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom home, but they will be ideal for these very small houses. And that we could also do it in neighborhoods that are underdeveloped and they can use some energy. And it makes no sense for a private developer to go and invest in these communities, but it's great for us because it somehow re-energizes the landscape. And it does it in a way that, yeah, you're giving a house, someone is happy to live there, but also the community can, you know, feel good that there see some new energy being built around them.
Can people see the designs for tiny homes online?
Yeah, the USF School of Architecture has been behind the effort, but all the work is available on the Celebrate Outreach homepage. And also I could be contacted and I will be happy to share the students' work and Celebrate Outreach work.
All right, we're going to talk more about that in just a moment. John Stewart is here. He's in the studio with us, and that was Josue Robles Caraballo, who is a professor at the USF School of Architecture. And also here is Sabina von Alak, who is with a nonprofit that works with the homeless, and it's called Celebrate Outreach. John, I'm still struck by that number that you gave out at the top of the show, 3,100 kids in Pinellas County homeless. They may not recognize it, but I gather they maybe sleep on couches and they're not really outdoors necessarily, but they don't have a permanent place.
Right, and it definitely affects their lives. There are programs in the Pinellas County school system to help homeless kids.
Why so many kids? I mean, is it the parents are underpaid? Is that what's going on?
I think that's part of it. It's part of the whole social problem.
Sabina talked about affordable housing a moment ago.
And that's also part of it as well, yes. Yeah. And, you know, I was a teacher for 37 years, and you wouldn't know because kids feel embarrassed that they're homeless when it's powers beyond their control. So it's difficult to find them sometimes. But there are programs in the school system to help.
Mm-hmm. Sabine, did you want to add to that?
Well, yes, I wanted to say, in addition to that, you mentioned the word retractable, which is perfect because there are children who they're now second generation. They know no other way of life. And that is a huge issue that we as a society must deal with and help them with.
Well, we're going to take some phone calls from listeners. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. First call is from Bruce in St. Petersburg. Let's go to Bruce. Bruce, what's your question for our guest?
Well, just say hello to my fellow Celebrate Outreach people. And I think the fastest growing group of homeless are actually families with children and women. And it is for a variety of circumstances. Often they want to hide because they're afraid of repercussions from the state, and that's why we don't see them as visible. The other thing I'll say is...
Wait a minute, what kind of repercussions from the state?
Well, you know, the state says they won't take kids away from parents because they're homeless, but the facts bear out otherwise. And in many cases, kids have been taken from the home under the guise of neglect, simply because they're homeless. And then there are the women that are fleeing, and sometimes men, domestic abuse situations where they want to remain confidential and they don't want it known. And then the other factor that's happening with homeless folks now increasingly is that cities are criminalizing homeless, whether it's meal sharing, whether it's trespassing or just being on the street in general. St. Pete and really Florida is notorious for being one of the meanest cities or states and cities in the country when it comes to the homeless, according to the National Law Center on Poverty and Homelessness.
Is that true? Is that true under Mayor Kreisman?
It's true under both mayors.
Yeah, so not just the previous mayor.
But all the mayors that have happened have been played their role in criminalization. And there's a lot more to be talked about. I don't want to take away from what your guests are talking about, but criminalization is an issue, and there is a Florida Homeless Bill of Rights that's going through congressional channels, as is a strengthening of the hate crimes law against homelessness.
All right. Bruce, did you want to add anything else?
Well, just, you know, I think that housing is the key issue, whether it's housing first, which is the federally mandated model from HUD, or it's taking the vacant housing that exists or creating tiny houses. You know, we have this problem with affordable housing on top of homelessness, and we're going to see an increase continually of homelessness. And I don't think it's ever really gone down over the last 7 years. It's just that it's become more hidden. Just like unemployment statistics, once you're off the unemployment rolls, you're not counted anymore. So all those factors should be looked at. And the Florida Homeless Action Coalition, as well as Celebrate Outreach and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, are all looking at issues. And I commend our guests and colleagues there.
All right, Bruce, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. John, tell us what's going to go on Friday night.
Well, tomorrow night, it will be the 28th annual Still No Room in the Inn, Carol Sing. This was started by ASAP Homeless Services. Some long-time residents may remember their good work with homeless families. After they closed their doors, Celebrate Outreach has picked it up. We will be gathering at the Unitarian Universalist Church at 6:30. That's at 100 Mirror Lake in downtown St. Pete. And all this is on the Celebrate Outreach website. Then we'll be singing at a residence for women. Students from Osceola High School will be bringing gift bags. We'll be going to Kara House, which is another residence, and we'll be going to the shuffleboard courts and stopping at other places along the way. And we will end around 9 o'clock at the manger scene in downtown St. Pete. Now, if it is raining tomorrow, bring your raincoats. We're going to go anyway. We'll maybe shorten it, because I think what's important about this is it's a lot of fun. It also draws the attention to the fact that Jesus was born as a homeless refugee, which tends to get obscured in all the sentimentality around Christmas. But it's also great for folks in these residences to know that lots of people care and lots of people want to bring them Christmas and holiday greetings and cheer. So we'll be doing that at 6:30 tomorrow night. As I say, it's the 28th annual. It's a lot of fun, and I hope folks will join us. More information, you can go to the Celebrate Outreach website and get all the details. But it's become a tradition for a lot of folks in the Tampa Bay area.
All right. Here's a question from Robert. Robert writes, has Josue looked into 3D printable homes? I read a while back about a Russian company that was doing this. They're supposed to be cheaper to build. Josue, have you heard about this?
Yeah, we have taken into consideration when we started considering the design avenues. We initiated with 28 design proposals, ranging from shipping containers, reusable pallets, and we experimented in many ways. We have looked into that into the technology that now it's more of it's now way more available than it was before, but it's still price prohibitive. because it's not as available to everyone, and it's also not as great to. We're also thinking we want to get the first one built, and that's why we need, you know, the help now. But we're also looking into maybe building many more of these, and we want to create a system that it could be easily replicated, and it doesn't rely on like specialties or technologies. We want to think of using a design that basically could be built by easily by any contractor.
And you say that you want to build the first one now. What help do you need? If there's somebody in the public that could provide something for you, what's the biggest help that you need?
Well, like the one thing that we get is that people love what Celebrate Outreach is doing, and they constantly ask us, you know, in how they can help. And I think Celebrate Outreach at this point, what it needs is mainly funds to potentially have someone that is homeless now and have a home soon, you know, be able to, we need the funds to change someone's life. And I think, I mean, that's immeasurable. But we need the funds to do so.
So you need money, yeah. Money to build a home, Sabina?
Yes, indeedy. I mean, we are looking to, we have Courtney Allen, a local businessman who has developed a business plan for us, and he's put us on a very aggressive plan for the next year. We want to have our first resident in his, her house next December at this time. To do that, we have to raise the funds. It's calculated at $100 per square foot. We're talking under 500 square feet. We have another, we've raised a third of the first house. We need another $30,000. So we're looking for sponsors. It really comes down to that. And after that, we'll need volunteers and we'll need a resident and more kind of things. But right now, it's just really concrete capital campaign time.
All right. And Sabina, where can people donate if they want to do that?
Right at the website, Celebrate Outreach. We have those electronic payment potential, or always there's a check. We're not picky.
Here's a question. Do cities have rules governing how small a home can be?
Yes. That is one of the things that, one of the factors that we had to consider. And our homes are, we initially looked in several neighborhoods within St. Pete. And we are designing homes that are code compliant and will be able to meet those minimum standards.
And when you talk about $500 or 500 square feet, you're talking about a usable kitchen, a usable bathroom, and all the electrical. Is that right?
Yeah. One of the biggest issues with the fabulous mini homes that we see on TV that everyone loves is that because everything is so small, they're very expensive. You know, they like most features are custom features, are not things that any contractor can just go and pick up at the local hardware store. And that makes it also price prohibitive. So we design a full-size kitchen, we design a full-size bathroom, and we also started to design layouts that would be universally used for for someone in a wheelchair or someone with a disability. So we didn't want a design that it would have to be retrofitted or changed after the fact if you have disability. We believe that, no, it's important to have a design that it could accommodate for many. And that was also great working with the students because USF has students from many different parts of the country, if not the world, and it was great to see how they, something as simple as the living room, what is a living room? And start to think about what's the space that it needs to, a home needs to have for someone to be functional. And that's why we end up with the size. And that's why we also wanted to take into consideration what's attainable around us. And that was one of the big factors of ending up with like a big size kitchen and also a functional bathroom that, you know, it will be like the ones we have in our homes.
Well, Josue, if people want to see the designs that the USF architecture students and yourself have come up with for small homes, for tiny homes, so where again on the web can they see them?
Once again, yeah, they can go to Celebrate Outreach homepage, and they will have some of the work along with the process. I will be happy to answer any emails or share any more information if requested. But definitely just a Celebrate Outreach will be the contact gateway and also where the design will be featured.
And that's Josue Robles Caraballo. Also here is Sabina Von Alloc. Sabina, you're with Celebrate Outreach. Is there anything you'd like to add before we go?
Come join us tomorrow night at Still No Room at the Inn. It is a wonderful chance to mobilize and have a terrific fun time.
All right, tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown St. Petersburg on Mirror Lake, 100 Mirror Lake Drive. John Stewart, thanks a lot. Did you want to add anything before we go?
I just wanted to say that whatever you're interested in is in serving homeless people, Celebrate Outreach has something you can do. We have the meals. We have all sorts of activities. We have the tiny homes. I'll point out that today is Pearl Harbor Day, and my father was a veteran of World War II, and he's living very well. I'm living very well, but not everyone is. And this is a great chance for you to remember veterans and also observe Christmas by helping Celebrate Outreach, Tiny Homes, and our other programs.
All right. The event is Still No Room in the Inn tomorrow night, 6:30 in downtown St. Petersburg. John, Josue, and Sabina, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks.
You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. In a moment, we're going to talk with one of the candidates for Florida governor. Listening to WMNF in Tampa. Next year, next November, Floridians will select a new governor. Governor Rick Scott is term limited out of office. Right now, there are several contenders for the Democratic nomination for governor next year. We're going to meet one of those contenders in a moment. The Republicans also will have a primary for governor. It's unclear exactly who's going to be in that primary right now, but we'll know a whole lot more in the next few months. We're joined now by Andrew Gillum, who is one of the Democrats running for governor. He's the former mayor of Tallahassee, and he is running and has been running for several months now for governor. Andrew, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Yes, Rob, it's good to be here with you. And I actually, last I checked, still am serving as mayor of Tallahassee.
I'm sorry about that. When does your term end?
Set me before it's time. Thanks so much, Rob, for having me on. And I thoroughly enjoyed the little bit I was able to hear of John and Sabina's comments and the great work that it sounds like they're doing to help end veterans' homelessness, a task close to my heart.
When does your term as mayor end?
It coincides, obviously, with the November election. So I'm mayor until November.
All right. My apologies for that.
Don't worry.
What would you do about the problem of homelessness? It's a problem in all the corners of the state of Florida. What would be your approach to dealing with it if you were elected governor?
Yeah, well, first on the issue of veterans homelessness, I have been one of the mayors to join with our mayor's task force at the United States Conference of Mayors to commit to ending veterans homelessness. We, in fact, just 2 days ago in the city of Tallahassee, had a ribbon cutting on our tiny homes project. We also put a significant amount of public resources combined with private resources to build a brand new emergency homeless facility that also included and co-located in the space is job training programs, the ability to get your GED, the ability to get financial counseling so that we can move people from homelessness into hope and into independence and independent prosperity. Tiny homes is just one step to helping those individuals gain that level of independence. But we need a continuum of care in this state as it relates to addressing the issue of homelessness. Very rarely is it simply a matter of a person not having a roof over their head. There are oftentimes other elements that are confused in the middle of it. Sometimes it's economic insecurity. Actually, most oftentimes it's economic insecurity. The absence of the ability to find gainful employment and wages that allow you to self-sustain, an absence of affordable housing at the lower income level. And obviously there are issues of substance abuse, mental health abuse. Many times with our returning veterans, the inability to get access to the kind of wraparound services that they need to, again, find themselves in their self-sufficiency. And so I would build off of the experiences that we've had in my city, in Florida's capital city, Tallahassee, and establishing continuums of care over the state that address some of the very, nuanced elements of homelessness, and then incorporate it into our sheltering program, a real sheltering first agenda where we shelter our individuals and then provide to them the kind of necessary supports that they need to move into independence. And I'll just end on this point on that question, Rob, which is to simply say that many of these kinds of services exist in our community, but they're in individual, you know, buildings, locations that are spread across our cities, whereas what we've had the experience of doing in Tallahassee is bringing many of them into the same location, helping them to set up outfits, providing them office space and staffing space, next to our homeless population so that those folks have easy access to the resources that they need to, again, move into independence and hope for themselves and for their families.
I want to ask you about wages because I think it's tied to the question of homelessness. In the last 7 years or so, our governor has helped. He's presided over the creation of hundreds of thousands of jobs. I was looking at the numbers the other day. About 15% of those jobs are in low-paying service sector kind of work, and that here in Florida, our minimum wage is a little bit above the national average because Florida voters decided a few years ago to raise it above the national average, but still take-home pay is only at minimum wage about $300 or so. There are homeless workers at Disney World. I've met homeless college students. If you look in the want ads or look online for an apartment here in the Tampa Bay area, you cannot find an apartment at $300 a month.
That's right.
You cannot find an apartment. It would be hard to find an apartment under $500 if you're lucky. And most apartments are $800, $1,000, $1,200 a month here in the Bay Area. What would you do about wages?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on a lot of themes there, right? I mean, firstly, obviously, the minimum wage in this state is abysmal. $8.10 is still the state's minimum wage, which is one of the reasons why I have come out, I believe so far, the only candidate that has come out to endorse the $15 minimum wage, and that each community, at the very least, aspire to a livable wage for their region, for their area, to make sure that people are able to take care of themselves. And provide for themselves and their family by working one job and not multiple jobs and still living in squalor and poverty. One of the things that I think that we've got to absolutely address next to the wage and increasing a livable wage in this state is to deal with some of the housing crises that exist in all parts of the state of Florida. It's not isolated to Central Florida. We experience it in Northern Florida and obviously in South Florida on the east and the west coast of this state. The access or the lack thereof to housing that's affordable and accessible for working people. 46% of the folks in this state, working folks in this state, says they cannot make ends meet at the end of the month. And so we've got a couple of levers within our government in order to increase and expand the availability of affordable housing. A few of them include making sure that the Sadowski funds that were established in state constitution to go toward expanding and increasing the share of affordable housing in this state needs to be fully funded. And the Republican legislature, who for the past 20 years have diverted those Sadowski funds,
put them over into the general budget fund so that they could finance their tax break for wealthy corporations in this state. That money needs to go toward its intended purpose, which is to expand the inventory of affordable housing in this state. But there are also steps that can be taken in concert with state and local government to take very aggressive steps to expand affordable housing in their areas. In my city, we, and I was proud to sponsor an inclusionary housing ordinance, which said that anytime you develop 50 or more units, that 10% of those units have to be developed at the affordable housing rate in our community. There's also the ability for local governments in partnership with the state to expand housing trusts and land trusts that allow you to set portions of land that is publicly owned or through a P3, a public-private partnership, to set that land into its own trust and for 100 years, 99 years, to be able to cap the growth of the property value growth of that land so that you can, into perpetuity, certainly for nearly 100 years, make sure that that inventory remains affordable for the folks in our community. Got to do this. It is an emergency in many parts of our state. And I'll give you one example. We've got hospitals in the state of Florida and many of our more populated parts of this state that are Trauma One centers that are having their Trauma One designation threatened because in order to be a Trauma One center, all levels of your employees that are critical to the Trauma One response time have to be within a certain driving distance to the hospital in order to respond to one of those events. And unfortunately, we're seeing housing not being available for many of those critical employees who would need to get to a hospital in a Trauma One situation who are unable to live in close enough proximity. They're driving 45 minutes, an hour or so, in order to get to work. And so that threatens our population. So this is not just a question of housing. This is also a question of the very health and emergency response to situations in our state.
We're talking with Andrew Gillum, who is one of the Democrats running for the Democratic nomination for governor next year. Next November, Floridians will pick a new governor. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can send an email into us at dj@wmnf.org. Just describe for me, you talked about the tax breaks that the governor had given to rich people. Of those, I think the governor claims that he's given 73 tax breaks during his administration. I might have that number a little bit off. What percent of those tax breaks would you say have gone to average Floridians and what have gone to special interests or the wealthy?
Yeah, well, overwhelmingly the lion's share of those corporate breaks and tax breaks that the governor touts have gone to corporations. 2 years ago, I think he had proposed $1 billion in his budget to corporations. Last year it was $500 million, a similar size this year, even though he is a late bloomer to now funding education at a higher rate so that we can increase our per pupil spending. But obviously, I'm suspect of that because we've also got to judge him by the last 7 years, where he has underfunded education and our K-12 system. And so I take those gestures as election year gestures and little more. When he had the opportunity to do more, he chose not to do more. Unfortunately, he's not alone in this. We've got a legislature, a House, and a Senate that have been intent on disembodying the public system, everything from public education through their efforts to increase the existence of for-profit private education that receives public money in the state of Florida. They have obviously aimed their attack at our public workers year after year after year, staving off their ability to have just cost of living increases, 3% increases in their salaries. And again, in a state as big as the state of Florida, with the fourth largest state in all, third largest state now in all of America, yet we are dealing with the challenge of how we create an economy in this state that makes way for all people. And by the way, I'm not talking about just folks who go to college and graduate with college degrees, and many of them are even struggling not only to pay back their debt but also to find work within their field. But I'm also talking about the need for this state to invest in blue collar work. When I was matriculating in this state in Miami throughout elementary and middle and my older brothers through high school, they were a trade. If they weren't on their way to college, they were able to do shop and woodwork and electrical and mechanical. And we have all but pushed that out of our K-12 system, certainly our middle all the way through high school system. And unfortunately, what we're telling those kids who are not on a college-bound track, the literal other half of them, is that, you know, good luck with the rest of your life, that there is no way for you, that there's no way for prosperity for you. Yet, we have shortages in many of those fields. And so I believe that we ought to return to some of the basics, which are equipping our young people with the knowledge and the skills and tools that they need to get access to the jobs that right now need employees, need workers, that are paying good, livable wages. We've got to invest in those folks, too. And I think we can do it by simply turning toward the future of this state, the future of energy in this state, by building solar farms up and down the length and breadth of the state of Florida. Those are jobs that you can't outsource. You need a man or a woman to build photovoltaic and to put it on rooftops and to put it out in fields. And by the way, it could exponentially expand for the Sunshine State, the amount of energy that we can pull off a solar grid system. That's just one example. Infrastructure would be another example. Dealing with climate change and a thorough way to build more resilient communities would be another example. Expanding Medicaid, which is federal money that could have come down into this state, $51 billion to date, $6 billion last year alone, that again could expand the workforce in a field that is badly needing workers because we've got shortages in the amount of nurses, shortages in the amount of teachers coming into our state. And so we can solve these problems by simply leaning into the challenges that our state confronts. We can solve the economic strain that many of the families in our state right now feel.
We're talking with Andrew Gillum, who's running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Andrew, what difference do you think it made that John Morgan, 2 weeks ago, the attorney from Orlando, said that he's quitting the Democratic Party, he's not going to run for the Democratic nomination? He made that announcement. He left open the door, though, that he might run for governor as an independent. Tell us what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, I tell you, I respect John Morgan, and I really hate to see him leave the Democratic Party. I think that as so far as I know, his value set, it aligns with our party, and I do hope that we'll have the chance to bring him back into the Democratic fold, because what we are fighting, what we are confronting at the federal all the way down to the state level at the hands of Republicans will require the strongest coalition of our party, as well as Democratic Leaning Independents, in order to win back some elections. As you probably know, the election in the state of Florida for Democrats has been lost these last two times by fewer than 1%. Fewer than 70,000 voters have determined the governor of the state of Florida, and unfortunately, we have not been well served by what the Republicans have brought to this state, not only this state but also this country. And so, we need the strongest a coalition of voters that we can possibly possess if we're going to win back this state. And I think that has to be the critical focus and the critical goal. Now, obviously, as I observe it as a candidate in the Democratic primary for governor, we now have a more settled field of four candidates in the contest. Obviously, due to some changes in the state's constitution, you now need a plurality in order to secure the nomination. I trust my opportunity to get a plurality of the vote better than I do anybody else competing and running in that office. And I look forward to securing the Democratic nomination and going forward to compete in November, not by shrinking from what we believe as Democrats, not by hiding from our values, but by sharing exactly what we believe. Our agenda around improving the economy, our agenda around investing deeply in public education to create an opportunity to learn for all people, our belief that people ought to have access to health care as a right and not a privilege. We ought to embrace that belief system and then give our voters a reason to turn out. And it is not going to be enough to say the other guy is bad. It is not enough to say the other side has not served us well. We've got to give our voters a reason to come out and to choose us. And I trust my ability to do that regardless of who we're competing against in the Democratic primary. It's my hope to win that primary and go on to compete to turn this state back over to working people again come November of 2018.
You mentioned the plurality. Does that mean that the next Democratic nominee for governor will have to get 50% plus one of the voters, of the Democratic voters?
We need one vote more than our opponent in order to get the nomination.
Oh, just one more vote than your opponent. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. So you talked about it there a little bit. The direction of the Democratic Party, there's all sorts of ideas about where the Democratic Party should go next and where did it go wrong in losing to Donald Trump. What are your thoughts about, you know, does the Democratic Party need to go in the direction of Bernie Sanders? Does it need to go in the direction of Debbie Wasserman Schultz? What direction does it need to be more moderate? Does it need to be more progressive? What are your thoughts?
I think we need to go toward our voters. We need to go toward where the majority of people in this country are. And the majority of folks in this country and, as I, you know, in this state, because that's where we're running, Democrats have the registration advantage in the state of Florida. Over 200,000, we've got the registration advantage. I believe that there are more people who subscribe to the belief system of Barack Obama than subscribe to that of Donald Trump. Unfortunately, 6 million few of them voted between the 2012 election and the 2016 election. I think we cannot equivocate on what it is that we believe. This idea, and this is, I think, one of the ideas that I'm confronting here even in the Democratic Party, that we've got to be more Republican-like in order to win, is a mistake. I think we've had our various variations of trying that strategy over the past 20 years in the contest for governor, and it has earned us a loss. That's what it has earned us. What we've got to do is recognize that we are the majority. And we've got to talk to those voters. And I don't mean just camp out in the bottom three counties of the state. I love the bottom three counties. I was born in one of them, in Miami-Dade. But the way we're going to win this race for governor is not by camping out there. It's going to be by visiting all 67 counties throughout the length and the breadth of the state of Florida, including the panhandle. Not because Bubba is going to choose us necessarily, but because there are voters there who believe like we do, who subscribe to our belief system, but they've never seen the Democratic nominee for governor, right? And so we've got to go there and give them a reason to be with us. I went to the Villages several months ago, and that is the most conservative voting precinct in the country, right? Every presidential nominee on the Republican side for president of the United States go through there, and they do a golf cart parade for them. Well, when I got there thinking I might need 50 or 100 folks, I got there, and this room was teeming with over 500 retirees and almost not another person in that room that looked like me. Well, we got to go there, and we got to talk to them and give them a reason to choose us. That's how we're going to win. I think this narrative of whether or not we've got to go to working class white voters or devil down on our base is a false narrative. I think we got to do both. I think we've got to talk to working class white voters and tell them how they are ill served by the Republican Party, how this Republican tax reform bill is a dead giveaway to corporations and into the 1% wealthiest folks in this country, and it's going to be paid by us, the working people of this country. We're not well served by Republican leadership, and we've got to take the blinders off and be willing to go to places where we may not be welcomed and certainly not invited and share what it is that we believe and give those folks a reason to choose us.
Who are your political heroes? Who do you like?
Well, I tell you, I mean, deal with the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, I mean, it would go without saying that Roosevelt played a huge role in the reconstructing of the American civil society system that we know today, the advent of Social Security and of Medicare in this country. I think he was a role model of progressive policy. And by the way, last I checked, the longest serving president in the history of this country. I admire people who, if I had to, you know, give a description of a typograph, I admire people who don't run from who they are and what they believe, that they're true to form, that they have not only an ideology and a belief system, but they're willing to share what it is that they believe. In some instances, I think Lyndon Baines Johnson is a bit of a model. He stood in the well of the United States Congress and pushed for civil rights in the aftermath of the assassination of President Kennedy and gave one of the most eloquent four speeches any of us have ever heard. And I'll tell you, if I had to choose a Republican, I'd have to say, in spite of the fact that I disagree with his public policy prescripts, probably every single one of them, Jeb Bush was the governor who believed firmly and wasn't afraid to espouse those belief systems, didn't run from them, and they showed up in his public policy and in his advocacy. And he radically expanded the power of the governorship of the state of Florida after he took leadership. And so I admire those individuals. Even where we may not agree on public policy solutions, I can certainly respect the fact that these are people who are authentic in their nature and are willing to fight for what it is that they believe.
You're traveling a lot around the state. You've been doing this for several months now as you're running for governor. You talked about FDR. FDR famously drove his car around Hyde Park in New York and Warm Springs, Georgia, and he went out and talked to the rural folks and the folks in the cities and found out what they were thinking and used that to develop his 1932 campaign.
Right.
What have you learned going around talking to people? What do Floridians say to you over and over again that let's say that the current governor hasn't accomplished?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, first of all, I got to point out that as we have moved around the state and we've been in the panhandle, I'll be in Tampa today and this evening, Orlando tomorrow, and then back up to Santa Rosa and the Florida panhandle on Saturday. So you're right, we are moving throughout this state. And one thing that I've noticed is, one, we've got a lot more in common than what separates us. The voters that I've encountered in the panhandle region of this state, which politically speaking is deep red territory, they want to make sure that their kids have access to a good quality education. They want a job that pays them a livable wage and doesn't require them to have to work two and three jobs to take care of themselves and their families. They want to be able to go on a vacation, a fishing trip, once a year even, and it shouldn't be too much to ask of them to be able to accomplish that. And by, goodness, this is no different than the urban voters that I've come into contact with who are concerned, yes, about the crime in their communities, but when they dial back, beneath the surface of reducing crime in their community, they say that our kids need opportunity. They need a good education. They need a good paying job. And so the first observation would be that we've got a lot more in common than what separates us. And unfortunately, the other side has been able to achieve great political wins through the old tactic, age-old tactic of divide and conquer. If they keep us fighting each other on the superficial differences, then we never get to the point where we recognize that at the depth of it, that we've got a lot more in common and a lot more if we decided to put our oars together and to row in the same direction, that we recognize that we could get great gains on all the things that we care so deeply about. Those voters in the Northern Panhandle and through the rural regions of this state are as concerned about getting sick and having to take a day off work as the urban voters that I come in and the city voters that I come into contact with. They're terrified that if they get sick, they can't go to work. And if they can't go to work, they can't earn a wage. And if they can't earn a wage, they can't pay their bills. And so we've got to make sure that the leadership that we're electing are attuned to that very dear reality and then have a plan for what we're going to do about shifting that narrative here in the state of Florida. And better than shifting the narrative, shifting that lived experience that far too many people in this state of 20 million people are struggling to make a way for themselves and their family from month to month. And I know a little bit about that. I grew up in a household with a mother who was a bus driver and my daddy who was a construction worker. And when there was no construction to be had, you could find my daddy on a corner selling fruits or vegetables or flowers or whatever he needed to do to make a way for his seven-headed kids and his wife and to make sure that we didn't go hungry at the end of the evening. And so that's an experience that I'm attuned to, and I think that's one of the reasons why it gives me so much passion around this race and to running and to winning, because I believe that we deserve a voice in politics and in government and in power as well. And as I've always been told, if you are not at the table, then you are likely on the menu. Well, it's time for us to be at the table and to start making some decisions that improve our livelihood. And not just the livelihoods of the well-heeled and well-connected 1% in corporations who have been running roughshod over the Tallahassee legislature these last 20 years.
All right. Well, Andrew Gillum, thank you so much for spending all this time with us here on WMNF.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity and look forward to connecting with you again soon, Rob.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Take care.
Right, take care. Bye-bye. That's Andrew Gillum. He is one of several Democrats running for the Democratic nomination for governor next year. And the general election will be next November. There'll be a primary in August, I believe. And you'll get your choice if you're registered as a Democrat to vote for one of the four Democrats running who've announced so far. There may be others. And the Republicans so far have three announced candidates, I believe. And if you're a Republican, you'll get your choice in the primary to vote for your candidate of your choice. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for Mitch Perry. He's coming up next with the Midpoint program. And thanks to James Lyles. He was our phone producer today. We had some vast technical problems. I'm surprised we're still on the air here, but we've survived both interviews with all the technical problems behind the scenes. Our engineers are working on it. This is WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for the news.